This episode of The Partially Examined Life is brought to you by St. John's College Summer Classics Program in Santa Fe, offering week-long discussion-based courses exploring timeless works of fiction, nonfiction, poetry, theology, mathematics, science, the arts, and philosophy for adults of all ages. Go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCSC for more information.
You're listening to part two of episode 134 of The Partially Examined Life. We are discussing Hegel's so-called logic. And
come on. So-called logic.
We were laying out the motivation for the logic as a response to Kant's critique of the limitations of reason and the desire to return to a proper metaphysics, let's say.
And we ended talking about speculation. About what speculation amounts to. It's something that's systematic. It's not merely wondering about what stars are made of or something.
So when he's talking about speculative logic, I mean, there's this kind of developmental structure to it. On page 33 in the Hackett, the quote is, "Hence the relationship of speculative science to the other sciences is simply the following. Speculative science does not leave the empirical content of the other sciences aside, but recognizes and uses it, and in the same way recognizes and employs what is universal in these sciences, the laws, the classifications, etc., for its own content. But it also introduces other categories into these universals and gives them currency. Speculative logic contains the older logic and metaphysics. It preserves the same forms of thought, laws, and objects, but it develops and transforms them with further categories." So there's a sense in which you're borrowing from all these different fields, but you're kind of fusing them into a unity and putting them in this developmental structure. And that entails putting in further categories for Hegel, things like concept and idea and notion, which are not exactly words that people in physics would use.
Hegel is reinvigorating the notion of speculative thought. I mean, one way of characterizing his criticism of Kant is to say that Kant cuts philosophy out at the knees of speculation, that there's no way you can go any further. And from Hegel's perspective, he just kills it. It no longer is getting towards the truth of the world. It's no longer doing what philosophy is supposed to be doing at all, which is enabling us to do this speculative activity. And I think in Hegel's context, in fact, it's actually constraining the activity of thinking itself, of the world itself, by stopping where Kant is and not continuing on. And that continuing on is speculating.
So to clarify, we're on page 26 of The Science of Logic, and we keep just jumping to the Encyclopedia Logic, which is the Hackett, is what we keep referring to, just as the need comes up. Since it's just cliff notes on The Science of Logic, we're just going to continue to do that scattershot treatment of that text, but let's keep going through The Science of Logic.
Yeah, so he's talking sort of about the way in which speculation gets curtailed by Kant. You know, again, he's continuing that conversation, and he sort of talks as if Kant sort of backed down at the last minute. Kant recognized these contradictions, so when we start talking about, when we start applying reason and using it metaphysically, we get these antinomies, these contradictions. We can argue that God exists, for instance, or that God doesn't exist. That sort of contradiction is an inherent part of speculation. And it's one of the reasons why Kant backed away, and he has this phrase, "When not carried through, this insight runs into the misconception that reason is the one that contradicts itself. It fails to see that the contradiction is, in fact, the elevation of reason above the restrictions of the understanding and the dissolution of them. At that point, instead of making the final step that would take it to the summit, knowledge flees from the unsatisfactoriness of the determinations of the understanding to sensuous experience, believing that there it will find stability and accord." So that's another way of saying we limit ourselves. We say knowledge is limited to the empirical and to our sensuous experience of things, and that we can't have knowledge of this metaphysical world, including God and things in themselves and so on.
And in fact, that limitation will give us certainty, which is explicitly part of what Kant was trying to do.
You're right. It's not that Kant is some kind of skeptic, right? He very, very much wants to rehabilitate empirical science and so on. And he does want to say that we do understand the world in a certain way, and we do have access to knowledge about the world, right, which is the point of transcendental idealism. But the point is the system finds itself in certain inconsistencies. I mean, he said, interestingly, the word he used was knowledge, right? Not can't. Knowledge flees from the, which again is pointing at the sort of broader story he's telling about the development of philosophy.
The world, though, here for Kant, though, means something very specific. It means appearances,
right,
as opposed to things in themselves. So again, that's the worrisome part of that. There are really two elements here. There's the fact that we can't have knowledge of God and soul and other traditional objects of metaphysics. And the other thing is the sort of diluted nature of scientific knowledge. The knowledge of the world is knowledge of appearance and not of things in themselves. I would say both of those are important to Hegel. Ultimately, the logic is going to embrace those contradictions. Kant is right that there are those contradictions, but for Hegel, ultimately, they're going to be a driving force of development. Instead of backing away, you can find a way to subsume those contradictions under a higher, something that's higher. You can find a way to reconcile them. I think that's going to be something we'll find out.
Becoming, the relation of being and non-being, and going all the way back to this tension that we talked about, that we see in Heraclitus and Aristotle, not the tension in the work, but the notion of there being a relationship, that things in relation that also form a whole. This will be a pretty radical set of relations, right?
The for itself and the in itself is basically what Wes was saying right now about Hegel recognizing that there is this sort of cleavage between the way things are for us as human beings to whom things appear and the way they are in themselves. But Hegel wants to say, okay, there's this for itself, i.e. appearances, the way things are for us, and there's this in itself, but we can, through the activity of reason, transcend these, right? Which is, that's kind of just clarifying the language of for itself and in itself that appears in Hegel and appears in lots of these people. That's what it's kind of pointing at.
Yeah. For Kant needed to make objects conform to knowledge, you know, so we construct these experiences so that then we can make objective judgments about them. The construction part sets us up for success, let's say. But for Hegel, it's, we're set up for success because that cleavage is a falling out from a primal unity. And that unity is fundamentally self-knowing. So there's a logical structure of the world, and our logical categories are aligned with it. So Kant, you know, sort of jerry-rigged that alignment as something subjective, as a matter of human cognition, and Hegel's going to jerry-rig it as something that has to do with the world, as this alignment between the structure of the world and the structure of cognition. So cognition is just another thing in the world that becomes a way of the world knowing itself by means of the very structure that the world is constituted from, this logical structure.
So just to clarify, it sounded like you were saying that it's the knowing itself that creates the unity, but it's actually the knowing itself that creates the schism, because it's one part, you know, whenever you...
You're right, yeah. Until you get back to absolute knowledge, yes, that's right.
Right. So being an in itself, as opposed to a thing in itself, I think we need to clarify a little more. A Kantian thing in itself isn't just an unknowable entity that is somehow the ground of experience. But an in itself is an item that does not reflect upon itself. It is just a unitary entity, but then once it reflects and becomes for itself, then it in a sense becomes two things, right? Because it is knowing itself, and so there's the knowing part and there's the known part. It's still underlyingly the same entity, but that's really his story of how there's plurality in the universe at all, that it's ultimately God, you know, is this unified thing and comes to know, to create these schisms within himself. Why? That's not an appropriate question, maybe, but
and the idea here is that the in itself is like an analogy to, you know, an Aristotelian idea of the development of a biological being. It's like the seed, it's the potentiality.
Yeah.
And it actualizes itself by becoming a for itself.
A tree becomes a for itself?
No, human beings and through consciousness become for itself. So that's the actualization of the rational animal.
Okay, yes.
That's your essence that, you know, that you achieve. It's developmental, and the contradictions reflect the developmental nature of things. The cleavage that we find, these contradictions that we find, they're growing pains.
I mean, it seems very different to talk about metaphysically that little picture that I was just giving of a God that splits itself in half, or even a fetus is an in itself, and then it gains self-knowledge and becomes a for itself, and thereby cleaves itself in a certain way. And even if you had a story about that, of there being a unified God and all the manifold things of creation kind of spill out through this process of self-division, that seems very different. Even though those things could be in conflict with each other, and you could kind of in a loose way talk about them contradicting each other, that's certainly very different from sentences that are contradicting each other, and the kind of example that we usually have when we consider this as an abstract bit of supposed Hegelian logic, that is, the kind of things that Kant brings up in the antinomies. For instance, when he thinks that Kant thought that when you speculate about the beginning of time, you think that, well, on the one hand, you can make a good argument for the world has a beginning. Of course, it has a beginning. The chain of causality couldn't just go on forever. But you could make an equally good argument for, well, it can't have a beginning. How would that work? Because then the beginning, everything is caused. So the beginning would have to be caused by something. So it must go on forever. So those are equally good arguments, yet they contradict. That's the kind of contradiction that Hegelian logic is supposed to solve. So what's the connection between this allegedly metaphysical picture of contradicting or at least different entities that somehow are different aspects of one entity that then kind of get overcome by thinking about their underlying union, and these contradictions that somehow get overcome through Hegelian dialectic?
The way I think about contradiction in Hegel is that contradiction is contradiction relative to a certain mode of knowledge, a way of thinking about the world, which falls into contradiction because it holds certain premises, it brings things together in a certain way, and it finds that the way that it's brought things together has led it into error in a certain way, right? So contradiction is contradiction relative to this kind of purposive structure of the way we make sense about the world. The fact is, the way we make sense about the world is directed in a certain way, and by virtue of these stages that it passes through, each stage contains contradiction within itself, right? So it's contradiction viewed within this sort of structure of returning to itself and all that stuff we've been talking about.
I was trying to think of an example of a kind of mode of knowledge which gives rise to a contradiction which then gets overcome. And I think there are many of these things. Picture two 12-year-olds. They're arguing. One says, this is a very current reference, Motley Crue rules. And the other said, no, Motley Crue sucks. They can't make up their mind. They're contradicting each other. And maybe a grown-up person will come and say, well, can you look at the underlying principle of why you think they suck? And in fact, that you're even dwelling on Motley Crue itself is a conceptual mistake. That you should just get over this and say there's an explanation for why you are thrilled and you are disgusted, but neither of those actually amount to a legitimate aesthetic judgment. You then, you know, turn 15 years old and transcend that, and so you have neither opinion. That's not a perfect, but at least it's illustrative.
Here's a quotation from Phenomenology of Spirit. The idea is we're trying to talk about logical contradiction in analogy to becoming, or an analogy to the growth of something or development of something. So the bud disappears in the bursting forth of the blossom, and one might say that the former is refuted by the latter. So here we get this application of logic to becoming in nature. Similarly, when the fruit appears, the blossom is shown up in its turn as a false manifestation of the plant, and the fruit now emerges as the truth of it instead. These forms are not just distinguished from one another, they also supplant one another as mutually incompatible, yet at the same time their fluid nature makes them moments of an organic unity in which they not only do not conflict, but in which each is as necessary as the other, and this mutual necessity alone constitutes the life of the whole. And we sort of get the hint of this in the introduction. The way he's going to develop his logic is going to be through this idea of something that's going to inherently develop out of itself, like something out of a seed. So he's going to start with being, and then he's going to make derivations from the most general idea of being, because things sort of naturally grow or fall out of that. That, of course, is not a temporal process of becoming. It's logical, but we can think about it in terms of this temporal process of becoming. And the thing that holds all the different contradictory things, that sort of the higher standpoint, the Motley Crue is both good and bad, is the organic unity that reflects the development of the whole, whether it's a temporal development or whether it's the logical development. So when you reach the endpoint of some sort of logical development, some sort of higher understanding, for instance, in philosophy, which includes all the previous theories and some sense, it's that latest stage, which is the true thing, and which, of course, will develop its own contradiction until you get to the big daddy, absolute knowledge, the final stage of which there's no further development needed.
There's just a slow decline.
Well, I was just going to ask a question about the description and then also about the relation itself. So I guess I don't know Hegel well enough to understand, you know, the big daddy absolute knowledge. I guess based upon this and my recollections, I would have thought that even in that stage, you have to have a unity that is embodying essentially a contradiction, that is embodying multitudinous relations to them, even though it is a unity.
Yeah, it includes the contradictions in its whole. But at previous stages, you know, you would get some organic unity that includes the contradictions of what came before, but then it develops a new contradiction outside of itself. And then those two things have to be held underneath a higher unity until you get to the ultimate unity, the one.
One aspect of this that was particularly confusing is understanding that you have becoming as being a relationship between being and non-being. On the one hand, that makes some sense that if in transforming from one thing to another thing, there is an aspect in which you must be annihilating the thing that you are to become something else. And so there's that aspect of being and non-being there. But it almost feels like there's a third term that's missing out of it. That's not like an adequate account of what transformation is. That becoming another is not simply embracing the not of what you were before. A butterfly is not simply the joining of a not caterpillar with a caterpillar. That's not what a butterfly is. And a man is not simply the joining of a not baby with a baby.
It's a not not baby.
Right. So that's where you get the positive, I think, that you have the negation and then you have a positive development out of that negation.
And that part's sort of utterly missing from where we are.
Yeah, we have jumped ahead of anything that we read about, but it's the basic idea of the dialectic that everyone sort of learns in school is, you know, thesis, antithesis, and then synthesis, just because when he's talking about contradictions, it's sort of an allusion to that. So for instance, on page 27, if our representation of the world is dissolved when we carry over to it the determinations of the infinite and the finite, still more is spirit itself, which contains both determinations within itself, something inwardly self-contradictory, self-dissolving. It is not the nature of the material, the subject matter to which they are applied or in which they are found that can make a difference, for it is only through such determinations and in accordance with them that the subject matter has contradiction within it. So he sort of segued, I think, from a discussion of Kantian antinomies to his notion of contradiction.
Earlier in the paragraph, he's trying to say, well, Kant wants to run away from the thing in itself, and these antinomies can't be determinations of the thing in itself, just before what you read. If they cannot be determinations of the thing in itself, still less can they be determinations of the understanding, to which one ought to concede at least the dignity of a thing. The determinations of finite and infinite run into the same conflict, whether they are applied to time and space, to the world, or to determinations internal to the spirit. Just as black and white yield gray, whether they're mixed on a wall or on a palette. And then you have the quote that you read, Wes, which I think really sums it up. Hegel saying, look, by running away from this, Kant, you're not avoiding the issue at all. And in fact, you're stepping away from actually where the center of it is, which is the very thing you were fearing, which was that the world dissolves into nothingness. You have no certainty. That actually happens, but that is the correct thing to happen if you understand what you should be doing.
One kind of example of contradiction, one ready one that we already have, is this notion of the thing in itself, which if you sort of outline it and the role it plays in Kantian philosophy, it reveals its absurdity, right? How your judgments are mapping onto unreality. I used to think about this as kind of a reductio. It's not exactly that, but it's like through the articulation of the particular view, it reveals itself to have reached a point which it itself finds unsatisfactory by its own criteria. And in this case, Kant's aim at getting at reality, Kant's aim at wanting to prove the reality of the world contradictory to, you know, people, skeptics like Hume and so on.
Right.
And he's like, hey, look at this system you've ended up with, despite your own aims, right? That's the pregnant sense of like contradiction here.
Yes, one of the sections of the Critique of Pure Reason is called Refutation of Idealism, which is basically him advocating his own version of idealism. Transcendental idealism as opposed to,
One way to kind of highlight this notion of contradiction is to talk about, this is in the phenomenology, but it come up later, but it's a useful example. This notion of sense certainty, which is this idea that true knowledge is a kind of immediate grasping of sense experience. You know, what's the true? It's this. I'm pointing at it. It's right here. You don't have to think about it. And then the point is you reveal, as you continue to articulate the view, that when sense certainty articulates its own view, it can only express immediacy with words like this, now and here, which, as Hegel elucidates, are the most abstract concepts possible, right? They're just words. They don't point at anything in particular because you need concepts to make distinctions and to point at particular objects. They're simply these abstract determinations which refer to everything and nothing. And thus, sense certainty, which was aiming to get at the true knowledge by shying away from any kind of abstract conceptual thought whatsoever, ends up entangled in the most abstract universal term. So that's another way to kind of see contradiction.
Yeah, there was something inadequate about the way that the progression through the phenomenology is supposed to be motivated. That is the action of spirit, that is knowledge trying to give an account of itself or become true knowledge, to become more elaborate knowledge. And the way I described it is imagining how an animal or just a very undeveloped person would describe experience the way that you were just saying with this. A couple of more things on this dialectic here. So the thesis, antithesis, synthesis, those are terms that Hegel never actually uses, although they are usually used to characterize him. They were actually invented by Fichte, who is one of the people that Hegel is arguing against. He was a straight-up follower of Kant.
Actually, he doesn't mention Fichte directly in this, but he alludes to him and sort of says yes and no. Fichte is sort of intermediate between Kant and Hegel. So,
well, we'll read some Fichte at some point, so we don't have to worry about him now.
Yeah, Fichte tries to desubjectivize Kant. He's the first step in that direction.
And the other thing, you mentioned the term sublate, and there's a whole rant in the Hackett version of the Encyclopedia Logic. There's not only a translator's introduction, there's three different translators. And there's a translator's introduction, and then there's even a translator's, like, minority introduction. In other words, two out of the three translators said, this is how we're going to translate this word. And then the third guy has to write his own introduction to argue why that was a bad idea in certain cases. That's how into the language these folks are. But in one of these, they're talking about this term that you just talked about as sublate. Aufheben is apparently the German, and it's a normal German word. It's just that it has two senses in German of canceling and preserving. So that's what sublate is, just because there's no good English term. So it's just become a convention that people use sublate, which sounds like a weird technical term, but really in German, it's just an ordinary thing. But you can see how if the previous terms, the two contradictory terms, are then synthesized into some viewpoint that is superior to both of them, but kind of incorporates the good parts of each, then each of them is canceled, yet preserved. The good parts are preserved. So there you go. That's what sublating is.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thesis, antithesis, synthesis terminology is actually a bit misleading. I mean, I associate it with, in the Critique of Pure Reason, there's these antinomies where Kant compares different views. But here it's more useful not to think about it not as, here's a statement, here's another statement, combine them, right? It's like, here's this mode of knowledge, and in its progression, it's like one thing, it's like one arrow. In its progression, it contradicts itself and then sublates itself. I think that's the sort of more helpful way of thinking about this.
Well, and it just made me think of a new plot for Black Mirror, which is a British TV show about various kinds of dystopias, that there should be a technology of sublation where you can, if you're not getting along with your spouse, then you just like do an electronic scan of them and create the computer version of them, but you can modify it to have the good things, but get rid of the things that irritate you, and then just get rid of the original. So you cancel yet preserve them.
But you got to keep going. You can't just stop.
Well, yes. If it's a Black Mirror thing, then it would show how that ends up as a dystopia, having this technology. That's the way the show works.
So speaking of the positive side of things, we're starting to get into that, actually, at the bottom of page 27 with Hegel. He's going to weed into this idea that logic is a content, because that's sort of the solution to things, and then it's talk of absolute knowledge. So at the end of page 27, the emptiness of logical forms lies rather solely in the manner in which they are considered and dealt with. So he's going to say, you know, this idea that logical forms are just empty and without content is actually just a, you know, artifact of Kant's and other people's poor treatment of them. Scattered and fixed determinations and thus not held together in an organic unity, right? So our discussion of this, you know, the need for an overall organic unity to hold the contradictions together is relevant here. They are dead forms, and the spirit, which is their vital concrete unity, does not reside in them. Therefore, they lack proper content, so we need the organic unity to get the content, a matter that would in itself be substance. The content which is missed in the logical forms is nothing else than a fixed foundation and a concretion of these abstract determinations, and such a substantial being is usually sought for outside them, which makes me think of God here, actually. but logical reason is itself the substantial or real factor which, within itself, holds together all the abstract determinations and constitutes their proper absolute concrete unity. So in other words, we don't have to look outside of logic for some foundation to its unity. It has its unity within itself. And that unity is what provides it with content. Is there any way to spell out more what that means?
You might think about concepts as containing like internal need to get at what's outside them. But also this notion of determination you want to get from abstract concepts which don't signify anything at all. Like I was talking about this is a sort of like indexical term, to concrete concepts which allow you to see objects in their particularity, right? Allow you to pick them out by making distinction. The way he thinks you get from these abstract concepts which don't have any relationship to anything to these concrete concepts is through the process of negation, because that's how you determine a single thing apart from like the background in which it's held, right? It's like you have to pick that out and thus negate the kind of background which it previously formed a part of.
And that's going to be his method of derivation. Kant calls it his transcendental deduction of the categories. The logic here, so it's going to be analogous to that, except that, so here, also on page 28 and 29, he's sort of critiquing Kant for, you know, look, you inherit these categories. His deduction essentially is saying, yep, they're necessary for experience. For Hegel, the deduction is to start with one thing, which will end up being, and showing how everything else organically, sort of developmentally flows out of that. That's going to be his version of the deduction in the body of the logic.
Which will all be revealed next episode.
Yeah, being is kind of like the ultimate demonstration of what like an abstract concept is, right? It's like
right,
being.
The most abstract. He wants to start with the most abstract thing, and then, yeah, you're all set.
Yeah, determinate being. I mean, it's when Dylan was talking about becoming, that's what I wanted to say about. The way I understand what happens after non-being comes in is that being becomes determinate. So it's like, you know, once you introduce non-being, you don't have to say, oh, everything is one thing. You can begin making these distinctions, which is what Hegel thinks negation does.
Okay, well, let's not pursue that because we're going to do that next episode with some rigor.
And vigor.
In this, the thing that Wes just read, I agree that there's the notion of contradiction that is used to derive it. But just to reread one sentence, he says, scattered in fixed determinations and thus not held together in organic unity, they are dead forms and the spirit, which is their vital concrete unity, does not reside in them.
He's talking about the categories there.
Yes. And particularly the Kantian categories, right?
Yes. Yes.
And what I want to draw attention to is A, the fixed determinations and them not being held by organic unity, because in that being the problem, there are going to be two things that'll happen. Or that are missing, that the determinations need to be more fluid and they need to be held together organically, which seemed to me to go together with one another. If you're going to be even talking about the notion of becoming and transformation and having that be a kind of unity. And that is holding in itself this notion of activity and internal development. And development isn't even the right word, right? Because it's sort of there. But it's really that these relations are dead because they don't allow you to have any development, any becoming in them.
So can I give the intuitive way I understand this?
Yeah, please.
Which is just based on I remember reading the transcendental deduction, and it took me a long time, by the way, to just get the vague idea that he's saying, okay, it's the transcendental part is just that we assume we have experiences. And if we have experiences, what has to be true? For experience to be an experience, it has to be causal. If we took causality away, it would be a, you know, sound and fury signifying nothing, and the same for every other category. But I remember being absolutely baffled. I mean, I knew that categories came from Aristotle, but I would look at the table and I think, where did these come from? I mean, like, you're saying you're doing a deduction. You didn't deduct these individual categories. It was utterly baffling to me. You know, even after I got the general idea, it's like, okay, yeah, you historically pick these up. And there is no real concrete deduction of these particular categories. Well, Hegel is going to do that. And he's going to do it step by step. You know, he's going to start with being, and then we're going to unfold from there. So that's the organic unity that you get with his little developmental process. And it's also, I suspect, going to be just, it's more satisfying in that sense. It's more specific.
So if we are quick enough in our sequel episode to get through Being and Becoming, then folks can look forward to us deriving quantity from quality. Whoa.
Yeah, maybe that doesn't actually happen, but we'll see. I'm giving Hegel the benefit of the doubt.
It's a generous reading.
It could end up the same feeling that I got from Kant, but
I don't know. I mean, what do you think of this whole thing as a, you know, we haven't seen the money. We haven't seen the payoff. We'll explore next time whether, but I can see how one might be inspired to say, wow, yeah, we should be able to actually do metaphysics and not wuss out like that Kant did. And sort of just as a really extended polemical, well, maybe it's too calm to be polemical, but an argument for this whole, you know, this is all about method. I don't know. Is there something inspiring about the method itself without even knowing whether it bears fruit? Or is that just something that's foreign to our American sentiment?
Well, we haven't even really
gotten
to the method. No. We've just gotten through his objections to his motivations for doing this. And his
we haven't even started.
Yeah. Well, let's get into the method.
What we've done is we've done exactly what Hegel does, is we've talked for a very, very long time about like four pages. And it turns out to be pretty interesting, but it doesn't get you very far very quickly.
And actually, we're almost done with this. And I think, you know, we could just say a few more things about the introduction, because we're about to reach the climax, so to speak, where he talks about absolute knowledge. It's my favorite part. So he talks about the phenomenology of spirit a little bit as an example of his application of logic. You know, the whole point of this is to get to a pure science. So on page 29, the concept of pure science and its deduction is therefore presupposed in the present work insofar as the phenomenology of spirit is nothing other than that deduction. So the idea of this developmental progress from deficient ways of knowing all the way up to absolute knowledge. And then we're going to get a little blurb on that here. Absolute knowledge is the truth of all modes of consciousness, because as the course of the phenomenology brought out, it is only in absolute knowledge that the separation of the subject matter from the certainty of itself is completely resolved. Truth has become equal to certainty, and this certainty to truth. So I actually, by the way, I was thinking here of certainty of itself as the self-certainty of consciousness, right? The fact that the sort of old Cartesian idea that what we have available to ourselves is our own conscious, and that's what we can be certain of. And then the whole problem is to get at objects. And that sort of reaches catastrophic proportions in Kant, where what Kant thinks of as the world is sort of within the realm of the self in some sense, and the things in themselves we're entirely cut off from. So absolute knowledge resolves that contradiction. Certainty and truth sort of coincide now because we're no longer accepting, and we can show how we can get out of that contradictory bifurcation between knowledge and object.
Well, so back where you had quoted on page 29, that paragraph, objective thinking is thus the content of pure science. And he has a couple sentences at the end sort of summarizing, I think, part of what he's going after. Accordingly, logic is to be understood as the system of pure reason, as the realm of pure thought. This realm is truth unveiled, truth as it is in and for itself. It can therefore be said that this content is the exposition of God as he is in his eternal essence before the creation of nature and of a finite spirit.
So it almost sounds like, yeah, the logical structure of the world is God.
All right, before we go on with that, let's talk a little bit about what happens between being and becoming, which is sleep. And one of our sponsors this time is Casper, the online retailer of premium mattresses at a fraction of the price, because everyone deserves a great night's sleep.
Hey, Mark, I heard that you got a Casper bed. So how do you like it?
I like it a lot. I've actually had it now since, I think, September. So I would call that worn in. But yet, it is not a collapsed mess.
Do you sleep better on it than you did before?
I think so. I think it has more support. I mean, it's not saying a lot because our mattress before was a complete wreck, but I like these obsessively engineered mattresses that combine latex and memory foam technologies. Those are pretty sweet, and I wasn't used to that technology before. They're just very firm. They have just the right sink and bounce.
And you didn't have any problem getting used to memory foam latex mattress when you didn't have one before?
Not at all. It's super soft, super comfortable. You can buy it online, completely risk-free. It comes wrapped up very tight in just a box. You wouldn't think a whole mattress could be stuffed into a box, but yes, you open it and it springs out. They offer completely free and painless returns within a 100-day period. You don't have to lie down in a showroom, which actually doesn't really tell you how well a mattress is going to work out for you. So Casper really understands the importance of truly trying out a mattress that in all reality you spend a third of your life on. You can get a Casper mattress for $500 for a twin bed or $950 for a king-size mattress. Compared to industry averages, that's an outstanding price point. You can save an additional $50 as one of our audience members by going to casper.com/PEL and entering the promo code PEL. That's casper.com/PEL, promo code PEL. Terms and conditions apply.
This episode of Partially Examined Life is brought to you by St. John's College Summer Classics Program in Santa Fe. The Summer Classics Program at St. John's offers week-long seminars in timeless works of fiction, nonfiction, poetry, science, the arts, and philosophy. Summer Classics attracts a community of people who are passionate about the life of the mind and share a passion for thoughtful reading and serious discussion of the greatest books ever written. It's no accident I was a tutor at Summer Classics in July 2015 and that I brought my family along to enjoy the beautiful and inspiring Santa Fe history, climate, skies, and unlimited access to national forest and high desert. My family and I had a wonderful week last summer when I taught a seminar on Chekhov's short stories. My class had participants from around the country, from all walks of life, from 25 to 95 years old. In addition to the wonderful discussions with seminar participants both in and out of class, my family and I enjoyed evenings eating at wonderful restaurants and attending a flamenco theater show in downtown Santa Fe. My boys and I spent hours hiking in the beautiful High Desert Park just footsteps from the campus. It was a memorable time for my whole family. The Summer Classics program has 27 seminars to choose from over 3 weeks in July. Registrations for seminars are happening now until classes are full. Study one or two topics in depth over the course of a week. You can take a morning and an afternoon seminar, or leave the afternoon open to explore Santa Fe. Students are sent books and materials in advance and read before they arrive. During the seminar, the group performs a closer reading of the text together. Lunch is provided, and there are several social gatherings during the week. For your summer vacation, combine your love for great books with the beauty, art, and outdoors of Santa Fe, New Mexico. To join a diverse global group of intellectually curious, like-minded folks for a stimulating week of inquiry and discussion in one of America's most picturesque settings, go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCSC. That's partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCSC. We thank St. John's College Graduate Institute for their support of the Partially Examined Life.
Okay, let's get back to the discussion.
There's obvious kind of like Spinozistic influences here. I mean, he talks about Spinoza a bit in the encyclopedia, which is interesting. I mean, it's very easy for someone who's sort of interested in Hegel to talk about, at least in a modern context, to kind of leave aside or set aside the kind of theological ambitions. But it's there. No, it's really hard to avoid. The God talk is all over in the preface to the Logic. It's absolutely saturated. The Protestant resonances of all of the kind of stuff we've been talking about, you know, here's this universal God who's incarnated as a particular, right? The movement is like God and Jesus and so on and so forth. And there's tons of this stuff which you can find. I mean, that element is there and he doesn't shrink from it.
It's reminiscent of Berkeley's idealism, actually, in which so once you're an idealist, you have to figure out how there can be a mind in the Berkeleyan sense, a mind-independent world, right? The world can't be dependent on your mind in particular. And so the world comes to depend on the mind of God. It seems like a very similar solution here.
Hegel would be horrified by that.
I know, because he's not what he calls a subjective idealist. And it's not that the world is composed of my particular ideas, which God, the same thing happened in Descartes, right? God came in to supply us with objects because we got cut off in our own little minds. But yeah, that God becomes the sort of unifying solution here.
I mean, it's one way to charitably render this, and this is kind of like skirting over the theological stuff a bit, but it's like the world, when it's finally made intelligible, once we get our concepts and categories and ways of thinking about stuff to align perfectly with it through the Logic, it is God, because all of these different contradictions between us and the world have been reconciled, and this kind of completeness that we've achieved is sort of divine in that sense, right? With the world has fundamentally, you finally, spirit has found itself at home in the world, and all these kinds of phrases that he uses.
I think the difference with Spinoza is that Spinoza was sort of identifying God with the natural world and was sort of thinking about things in terms of matter. Am I right about that?
Well, God for Spinoza was not imminent in all of nature. Nature is part of God, but there could be any number of aspects of God that exceed nature. So I do think maybe it's closer to, I think Hegel could agree with Spinoza's conception here that, that God is the all-unifying thing. I mean, we made the point in that episode that the world is both mind and matter, that those are kind of two aspects of the same thing, which sounds exactly like the kind of way that Hegel is talking about how there could be division with underlying unity.
Right. But the similarity with Spinozism that I was talking about is this whole kind of like fatalist determinist strand in Hegel, where, you know, all of this is kind of happening. When you read this, you kind of have the feeling that it's happening over and above individual people. And like, do we really participate in this stuff? Does it just kind of have to play out whether we like it or not? That has a kind of certain kind of similarity to Spinoza's denial of free will.
And he explicitly connects it. I think this is in one of the prefaces to the encyclopedia, which we were not supposed to read, but I accidentally was reading. And they were the most kind of angry part of all this. A lot of it is criticizing religious objections to his system. And one of was these people that are so patronizing toward philosophy of like, oh, those abstract thinkers, you know, people like Hegel, they don't think through like what the actual moral implications of their system would be. And so it's exactly what you're describing, that you might think that the moral implications of a determinist system is some sort of moral nihilism. And Hegel at that point explicitly pulls out Spinoza, like, hey, look, Spinoza had this view and look how sensitive his actual ethics are and how the most austere Christian would probably embrace the high ideals that Spinoza is putting forward in that. And that's what actually follows from being a determinist.
It's interesting. That's kind of supposed to be like a showing your hand thing in German idealism, where people kind of accuse Kant of being a Spinozist, where he's undermined your need to believe in God. And Spinozism is identified with this kind of like dangerous atheism. And Hegel is just like bringing Spinoza out to, you know, yeah, there you go.
This is if people want a popular version of what we've been talking about here, the book that we just released an episode on, this Eric Fromm, he has a section in that book on traditional logic versus paradoxical logic, which, well, he's drawing a little more on Buddhism and Taoism and the koans and that kind of stuff. But the way he describes it is exactly like what we've been talking about here, that there are things that seem to be contradictions and that you then go to some a higher level of understanding in which the contradictions are resolved and that there's this ultimate oneness. And not coincidentally, his take on the development in culture of different conceptions of God was to get more and more sophisticated ones until you get to basically Spinoza's version, where God is equivalent to the good. Just orienting yourself toward the good is what belief in God is about. It's actually not belief in a otherworldly entity at all. And so maybe Hegel ultimately, he gives whole lectures on philosophy of religion. But Amog, you had pointed us to a lecture that we'll point folks to on YouTube about, is Hegel an idealist? Or to what extent he's an idealist, and talking about Kant's idealism and how he's criticizing that. And that guy even says, look, I'm going to talk about Hegel's lectures on religion from late in his career. But despite all those lectures explicitly about religion, it's still very hard to say what Hegel's religious views are. Yeah, so even though he says things in here that make it sound like, yeah, he's the Protestant of his time, and certainly Hegelianism was taken up as being this kind of, well, the kind of Protestantism that Kierkegaard, as you were saying, ended up basing his whole career in reaction to, basically, it's still unclear. Maybe Hegel is a Spinozist.
There's stuff you can say about it, but all of this is like way outside the boundary of this, of what we're supposed to read. It's obviously relevant.
He finds it relevant. He brings it up in, especially in these subsequent commentary parts that he, it's just so hard to get a handle on what this logic is.
It turns out to be about God.
Yes. Yes. You know, as funny as that sounds, because Hegel's big criticism in terms of method is really, as soon as you start to try to give an understandable explanation of anything, the way you're doing that is you're bringing in matters from everyday life, from common sense, and those end up being extrinsic, irrelevant, only contingently connected to what you're actually trying to talk about. So I think at one point he says, look, just to make this clear, I'm going to give an intro here, but it's going to be a non-philosophical intro, because philosophy, as we were saying, has to determine its own method. And he spends a lot of time then toward the end of part of the Science of Logic that we read, just talking about what could possibly be a beginning for philosophy. What could be the first thing that, which we've already given away the answer, it's being the most abstract, highest thing. He spends a lot of time like ruling out anything else, then anything else ends up being extrinsic, ends up being too common. So if you try to get a handle on Hegel by coming at it from like, well, where does he fit? Is he a Protestant? Is like, no, that's all actually kind of foreign to his system. Even when he brings it in himself, the only way you could really understand his view of God is to follow, you know, either the phenomenology, which I guess ends with God, or this book all the way through and read it off there. And even the scholars who do that don't really understand.
Yes. We did kind of get close to it. I mean, it's not that he would completely disagree with what, like, me and Wes were knocking about here. It's clear that God is connected in some way to this unity, and that he thinks religion is sort of an important guide to this absolute and so on and so forth. Like, synthesizing that into what that exactly means in terms of what kind of entity he thinks, like, God is or something like that. You're right, that's complicated.
So should we say just a little bit about the method before we begin on page 32? For the dead bones of logic to be quickened by spirit and become substance and content, its method must be the one which alone can make it fit to be pure science. Sorry, I'm just reading that because I like the dead bones of logic. I guess page 33 is where we really begin to get into it.
I think, isn't it just like they have the cadaver of John Stuart Mill or something still in one of the British universities propped up somewhere, or his head, something like that? There's, I believe, the bones of logic. There's a pit where they put Frege and Russell, and they just have a little place where all the bones of logic go.
Wow, that's a really long setup. To get back to the bones of logic, it's a circle.
It's a snake fucking itself.
To talk about method, he's going to do what we've been doing a lot of, which is refer back to the phenomenology of spirit. So this is on page 33. In the phenomenology of spirit, I have presented an example of this method with respect to a concrete object, namely consciousness. It's interesting to hear that called concrete.
It's very concrete.
Yep. So at issue are shapes of consciousness, each of which dissolves itself in being realized, has its own negation for result, and thereby has gone over to a higher shape. It gives you another good idea of what we're already talking about in terms of becoming, and negation is related to that.
Well, I think you should read the next sentence, because I think it's a very concise statement of what we were talking about earlier.
The recognition of the logical principle that negation is equally positive, or that what is self-contradictory does not resolve itself into a nullity, into abstract nothingness, but essentially only into the negation of its particular content, or that such a negation is not just negation, but is the negation of the determined fact, which is resolved, and is therefore determinate negation, that in the result there is therefore contained in essence that from which the result derives, a tautology indeed, since the result would otherwise be something immediate and not a result. Because the result, the negation, is a determinate negation, it has content. It is a new concept, but one higher and richer than the preceding, richer because it negates or opposes the preceding and therefore contains it, and it contains even more than that, for it is the unity of itself and its opposite.
I know it seems like after all this talking around it that you just reading it straight through is very elucidating, but I think that's only because we've already been steeped into this, that the listener stopped listening after the first two sentences. So let's unpack that.
Just in reading it again, I still find it a little bit bizarre. But what he's saying is that the big fish eats the smaller fish. And that because the big fish holds a smaller fish in it, it's
sublated.
Yeah. It has progressed. That's the word. So I, you know, used a crappy analogy to describe something that was impossible to understand. What I would like to have some more clarity on is the... because the result of the negation is a determinate negation. So up until that point, you have being and non-being, you have things that something is self-contradictory, and that contradiction results in a determinate negation. It therefore has content, and because it has content and it holds in it the previous negations, it therefore amounts to progress. So those are like the poles of the argument. And the one that I find the most confusing is the notion of the determinate negation. Once you have something that's determinate, I suppose it has content in the sense that it's determined something. And then to the extent that in its content, it holds within it previous knowledge, it's in that way larger and amounts to some kind of progress. But how it results in a determinate negation is the part that I find, I don't know what it means.
Yeah, I mean, one way to think about this is to think about determinacy, i.e., you know, making something sharp, particular, understandable, intelligible in its particular features.
Doesn't it mean it could only be that way?
Yeah, that as well. Yeah, no, that's right. What determinacy contains within itself is this sort of element of exclusion. By virtue of having these particular features, which it has to have, it doesn't have all these other kinds of features, right? Which is relates to what you were saying about being and non-being, right? So if you're talking about something like being, what you're picking out is everything there is. There's no determinacy there, because it's this sort of abstract holding everything within it kind of word.
One of the reasons why there's no determinacy is because it's not like it's a thing you can compare another thing. Because what provides determinacy, right, is to have a higher sort of category. So for instance, I'm thinking of the sophist and this sort of hierarchy of classification. So you might have an angler and tuna fisherman. Those two could be subsumed under fishermen. And the idea is that determinacy involves being able to make this relation to another thing under the umbrella of another universal. And being, because it's the most universal, you can never do that. So it's indeterminate in that sense. It can't be determined over and against some other thing where there is a higher thing that subsumes them both. And so anyway.
And once you've got comparison, this thing over and against that thing, there's a negation. This thing is not that thing. Yeah. We've made a distinction. And now we have something like determinate being. We can pick out individual things, not just say everything is. This new concept is richer and higher than the previous just being.
Well, so this thing is not that thing. The problem with that is that it's not that thing. So if I have two things and they're distinct in number, this is not that. It's not the case that if I negate that negation, that I get back what I had before. Because if I pick that one particularity and say, I can pick anything else, any other thing in the whole world, and say it's not that thing, right? I don't see where that negation is a proper negation.
This whole determinate negation was making me think of how little kids, I know I had this sentiment myself, and I talked about when my kids were little, once they start thinking about opposites, mm-hmm. you know, day and night, they start thinking that everything is an opposite. And they start, well, what's the opposite of a grape? and yes. Imagine that the thing that you're starting with is sort of indeterminate being. It's an object, but you haven't specified what it is. And you say, well, what is the opposite of that? Well, let's imagine it is something, it's a grape, but even calling it a grape kind of is cheating because we're already labeling it, but it's an unlabeled thing. You could even think of it being labeled as a grape or being labeled as a fruit or whatever. If you say the opposite of a grape is a cherry or something, like then you're picking out some specific thing about, well, it's round, but it has this kind of flavor, whereas a cherry has a, you know, more sour flavor, whatever the distinction you're making. Or the opposite of a grape is a vegetable of something, because, you know, fruit and vegetable, you're actually picking that out qua fruit. Or is it, you know, the opposite of a grape is a stone? So that's the way that it becomes a determinate negation. Now, you're saying that if you then negate that negation, well, clearly you could pivot any which way, the same way you could pivot off the original grape, whatever the thing you've come up as is negation is, you could pivot any which way. It's just that the difference is that Hegel thinks that once you make the first move of negation, then there's going to be some logically determined way that you would then sublate both of them and come up with the synthesis.
Let me give you another example of determinate negation. Suppose you have a red canvas and you want to make sense of the idea that there's a, I'm going to put a red spot on that canvas. Well, there is no such thing as a red spot if the whole canvas is red, right? There's no way to distinguish it from the background. You need negation. You need a different color there as a background in order to see the red spot. And then those two things become subsumed under color. There is no such thing as red. If all the world is red, and then I say, oh, there's a red thing. No, it's not red. It's just we're back to being, which is red is another word for being. But it becomes a determinate thing in comparison to something else. And then those two things are subsumed under.
So what we're talking about here means that negation and contradiction are different things. Or maybe I just have a constrained notion of contradiction, because I'm interpreting contradiction as being opposite. But negation is going to allow for something more than just contradiction. It's going to allow for all the different knots that are there, which would be broader than my kind of simple-minded notion of the double knot being the same thing as not doing anything at all, as it being fully contradictory.
Negation is closer to something like distinction. I mean, that's the way I think about it.
I mean, if there's a contradictory part, I think it's okay to mention this again. When you start with being, and you say, okay, it's this most general term, and it's so general that it's not determinate and it's featureless. And so I can't distinguish that from nothing, That's the first step. Nothingness grows out of being for Hegel. And so it seems like you get an opposite. The opposite sort of springs out. The nothing springs out of being in this sense. And then you get the organic unity of those two things, which is becoming, I think, which is just the kind of thing we would call a determinate being. You know, the things in the world that we call beings, or you could call it a being. You know, this union of being and nothing into a becoming is where we can start talking about beings. Ultimately, the reason why all this is important is because he's telling us what his method is going to be. This is going to be his method of derivation or deduction, as opposed to what Kant did. So on page 34, he says, what propels the concept onward is the already mentioned negative, which it possesses in itself. So being, for instance, possessing nothing in itself. It is this that constitutes the truly dialectical factor. So what Hegel is saying here is all I have to do is start with being and, you know, water that plant a little, and I can just watch it grow and I get everything else that I need.
Water it, bringing in extrinsic water.
I don't have to do anything. It's self-watering. Sorry, it's self-watering.
It's like the magic of chia seeds.
If anyone could out-Kant Kant, you know, Kant thought he was doing a transcendental deduction, which means I need very little extraneous information. All I need to do is assume that there is such a thing as experience. Well, Hegel's saying, well, I can one-up you on that. I'm just going to start with being and then everything else. I don't even need to do any – well, yeah, he has to do some fancy legwork, but not the kind that Kant does. So anyway, and everything else comes out of that.
So if Hegel is negating Kant in certain ways, then who is the synthesis that takes up both into a more Kantian whole?
Actually, Hegel is both the negation and the synthesis.
Oh, okay. What a hog. Yeah. Hogging all the roles in the dialectic.
Well, I mean, actually, you could say Kant himself is a self-negation.
Yeah.
Well, for one thing, that Heidegger, oh, nobody thinks about the meaning of being. Nobody contemplates. Hegel, right here. Is contemplating the meaning of being. It says how hard it is for people to think about the is in an everyday sentence. How these.
To be fair, Heidegger is talking about exactly that when he says that people condemn being to be the most simple indeterminate concept.
Ah.
But, I mean, there's a sense in which he's trying to do the same. I mean, Heidegger has no time for this thinking stuff that we've been talking about. A, highfalutin concepts and not investigating everyday being in the world.
It actually brought to mind that Heidegger has a whole essay called What is Thinking? Just that whole, like, treating it as problematic. Well, Hegel is also treating it as problematic, that thinking ends up not being what you do every day when you muse about, when you sexually fantasize about the person next to you or something. That's not thinking. Thinking is a specific technical thing whereby these notions are converted into knowledge, into concepts.
But also, when you were initially describing the relationship between thought and world, there was a lot of stuff there about needing to take the world, needing to take into account the fact that thought is fundamentally a way that the world is and is situated in the world and so on. And I think Dylan even mentioned being in the world.
Yes. Dasein is determinate being. Well, we'll get to that next time. It's the slightly more specific version of being. It's not actually determinate in terms of it's a grape, but it is something. It's a something.
It's a thing rather than being.
The point I was trying to make was just that it is a certain kind of phenomenology, if you understand by phenomenology, a certain kind of conceptually guided fine-graining of our own experience. In that loose sense, I think it's a similar kind of thing.
So unfortunately, it's not just you take acid and the experience that you have of being the one. No, that's Emerson phenomenology. That's not Hegel.
Yeah, but also there are certain similarities. That's what I was trying to point.
Between Hegel and taking LSD?
That too.
Is it the slowing of time? Is that what...
It's the seeing of music.
Well, there's the whole idea that thought has to be understood as embodied. I mean, that's partly why you go through these, right? It's like, this is more in the phenomenology than here. The idea that you can't simply take a position out of the world and sort of fantasize without regard to the world. And just come up with your own abstract system, you have to take into account the fact that the true and the false, I mean, this is all phenomenology stuff, but it's played out here. So the true and the false, different modes of knowledge are competing in this way, which is why you have to do this. You want to show people who might have these skeptical doubts that this is the only way to go about this. And the reason you have to do it is because there's lots of different people saying lots of different things, and you got to make sense of that.
So let's make a pledge for part two that we will not talk about the phenomenology of spirit. We'll only talk about logic. But as a way of giving my closing for part one here, I was kind of pleased that this was as connected to the phenomenology as it was, because I was raised in my Hegel schooling to believe that the phenomenology was the young, vibrant Hegel and the logic was the old, crusty Hegel. But it's really not the logic that's the old, crusty Hegel. It's the history and the philosophy of right that's the old, crusty Hegel. This is in between. This is written right after the phenomenology. I guess I'd never put those two together. And so it's really the parts that we would object to in here are in the latter parts of the phenomenology of spirit. It's just those are the parts that I never get around to reading about the absolute and all that.
Especially going through the science of logic, our reading the second time, it was a lot easier. And I shouldn't be surprised. This happens all the time with interesting, good books, is that when you read it the second time, you just should never read it the first time. You should only ever read it the second time. That's just the way it is.
You know, I had that experience of reading it and thinking, yeah, this is gibberish, until I'd start really get into some secondary readings, which I really didn't have time to do. And then I just went back and was more patient. And because I had already given it once over and slept on it, you know, returning to familiar territory. And yeah, it was really quite enjoyable, actually, and interesting.
So, did you find the Kant helpful?
Yeah. I mean, I have a strong background in Kant, which is enormously helpful for this.
Though I have to say, maybe you can correct this understanding, Wes, but I don't find any characterization of Hegel of Kant to be wrong or misguided. It's not like he's providing a thorough reading of the critique, but his characterizations don't seem to be off.
The reason I was kind of hedging was because there's ways for like Kantians to duck and weave and weasel their way out of pretty much everything he says here, although I find it convincing.
However sympathetic you are to Kant, I don't see how you escape the problem of the thing in itself. Maybe there's ways for Kantians to do that, but I'm not familiar with them. So,
well, I think I would have been happy with our reading selection if we had just not assigned the second preface to The Science of Logic, which is the 1830 thing, because I'm reading the first preface, which is very short, and like, oh, this is fine. I mean, it's not saying. Then get to the second preface, I'm like, what is he talking about? And it pretty much just ruined everything for me. And I didn't get a second go-through of The Science of Logic. It was redeemed for me finally when I got around to the encyclopedia and like actually took good notes on that, and that was understandable. And the fact that it has that structure of commenting on his own stuff and these lecture notes that you were saying, Wes, were inserted from his students or something, mm-hmm. makes it a lot more fun. And
it does. Yeah, you're right.
But even in The Science of Logic, once I got through that horrible second preface to the actual introduction, which is what we've been talking about here today, I was like, oh, this is fine. This is, by comparison,
yeah,
is wonderful. So my earlier prejudice of early Hegel good, late Hegel horrible, confirmed.
The prefaces are indeterminate being.
Well, maybe one negates the other.
Yeah.
And you get the determinate being that comes in. Sorry.
I really enjoyed this book, which is partly why I'm interested in talking about it. And the kind of moves in here, which we really mapped out quite nicely.
You've read the whole thing?
I've looked through the whole encyclopedia, and I'm 75% through The Science of Logic. But as to whether it pays off, I don't know. It probably doesn't. I can't claim to have fully comprehended the system, but the kind of heavenly promises that we've been going through, I don't know that they're ever fulfilled.
I remember talking to you long ago, and I think that probably the effect of reading the whole of this book is that when you started, you had a straight up normal Canadian accent. Oh. And now you sound like that.
Really? Okay.
It's amazing.
Oh.
So I think the one lesson I get out of this is it makes me want to go find a small child and ask them, what's the opposite of day? And they say night. And you say, wrong. The opposite of day is Armageddon, where there are no more days. That's logic for you. So for next time, as we said, we're going to do more of this book, more Hegel's logic, but in particular, the Encyclopedia Logic, the easier of the two works, the one we talked about less in this episode. And we're going to do sections 79 to 99, which is a little more about what this project is, the good kinds of abstraction versus the bad kinds of abstraction. And then we actually see this applied to the most general categories, which are undifferentiated being and nothingness and becoming and quality and quantity. I have no doubt after listening to this discussion and that discussion, you will still have questions. Maybe you'll want to try your hand at talking about this yourself. So we are scheduling another after show. That's going to happen on Sunday, March 27th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Per usual, you just have to go to PartiallyExaminedLife.com, become a PEL citizen. Look in the Not School Study groups. In the list of groups, you'll see one for this after show. Merely join that group, and that will signal that you want to be included in that conversation, and you will receive an email with a link to join just before it happens. I also want to remind you about our newly relaunched Introductory Readings in Philosophy group. Instructor Brian Wilson will be leading a discussion on the Crito on Sunday, March 20th at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. Again, just sign up for Not School, join the group. That's all you got to do. It's the same $5 that will get you admission to both things and let you hear lots of bonus audio and all that stuff. We are supported by your donations. Please go to PartiallyExaminedLife.com to make a contribution. Big donors since last time have included Thomas Craigle, Philip Cherney, Kevin Beard, Clement Cole, Logan Blank, Lauren Josephson, Eduardo Rodriguez Lorenzo, Jack Martin, Alan Callister, Uriel Hernandez, Chris Larson, Eric Belotis, Bing Zhao, Linda Pullman, Jonathan Hussein, Adam Bibby, Ilko DeVries, Richard Pierce, Michael Mitri, Keith Morrison, Jared Frizzell, David Norbury, Rachel Feldman, Ian Kerr, Steve Grathwall, David Winfeld, Georg Wendt, Cam Yaremko, Susan Ryan Volmar, Bill Riordan, James McDermott, Hakon Engine, Nicholas Biddle, Roger Cranby, Eve Southwood, Owen Elnakowry, Scott Vargas, Kyle Sorensen, Bonnie DiScullio, Jeannie Carey, David Stanton, John Bouter, and Julia Quagliarello. Thank you to all of you, as well as to the people that bought stuff from our store or our smaller donors or became the $5 a month Partially Examined Life citizens. You guys are awesome. As is Amog. Thanks for having some things, some sensible things to say.
Thanks for coming on.
Because otherwise it would have just been Wes by himself.
My pleasure.
Folks should go and comment on this episode on the blog, partiallyexaminedlife.com. You could sign up and get our regular emails of brilliant blog content there. You should go subscribe to my other podcast, Nakedly Examined Music, which is where the sucks rules dichotomy is transcended to the next level of artistic appreciation. There you go. Callback. And while I'm on that topic, the episode of Nakedly Examined Music that just released features my old friend Steve Petrinko, whose music I've featured a couple times on this podcast from the time when he and I played in a band together in college. And the song you're about to hear at the end of this episode is another one of those. It's called Procrastination, which I chose because for this episode I procrastinated reading Hegel more than perhaps anything else that we've yet read. Please go listen to the interview with him. I think you'll find it entertaining. And follow us on Twitter and all that stuff. So good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.